Hey, what's going on, everyone? Thanks for tuning back in to the Davidson Hang podcast. We're at episode 136 now with Tony Nguyen, who's the founder and executive director at the American Young Leader Exchange, and you're based in the Bay Area. Excited to have you here.
Excited to be here.
I love your mission. You said it's to empower American high schoolers to become transformational leaders through a semester-long one-for-one domestic exchange student and scholarship program. And I know last time we chatted. Oh, and thanks for connecting us, Evan Baum. He's awesome. He's one of my dudes. And then ironically, I just met someone who knows Evan through like Greek Life, Lambda Phi Epsilon. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but we were both my mentee, who was paired up with me from the Society of Asians in Sales and Customer Success, like knows Evan as well. But yeah, it's just a small world how you meet people and like you have mutual connections. But yeah.
There's eventually you're going to run into an overlap. You're like, oh, that's amazing. And you're like, it's something I constantly think about, social networks.
Right. Yeah, especially for what you do, right? It's like when you're a founder, an executive director, it's all about that, those relationships you cultivate. And so I appreciate, you know, what you're doing, and I'm happy to be able to share a little bit more, you know, spread the word and help you along in your mission as well.
I really appreciate it. Our mission statement is very dense. So it'll probably help folks if I parse it out a little bit. Our mission is to develop and foster transformational leaders, ones who are familiar and exposed to the many diverse voices of American culture. Quite often, most commonly, you understand what we know about international exchanges, right? Go to a different place, experience that culture. But like America is so diverse in and of itself that it's just as eye-opening to explore a cultural horizon that's just within America. And so we do that. We do that through a cultural exchange here. Let me back up a bit. We're very siloed. We're in our bubbles. We're our geographic bubble. We're in our socioeconomic bubble. We're in a digital bubble, where whatever you read is most likely reflects how you think and how you feel. And if something doesn't agree with you, then you remove it from your feed.
Yeah. And so,
we end up eating our own dog food when it comes to thoughts, and that becomes a bubble. And so how do you get out of it? You physically move to somewhere else and you stay there for a long period of time and have mutual experiences with folks who think differently from you. And that's our program. On top of that, we also provide communication workshops in order to give the kids, sophomores and juniors, tools in order to fully understand and process their new environment. They'll get tools as like active listening, conflict resolution, and as well as an overview of like, these are the cultural regions of America. You got the Yankee region in the Northeast, and you have the Deep South, and you have the far left West, and they have fundamental values that are different. And to better understand that your experience, you're like, oh, this is why people think the way they do. They have underlying values about community individualism or community endeavors. So you have workshops before, you have the exchange itself, and then you have coaching, where you have coaching one-on-one. Every 2 weeks, you'll check in with a coach and they'll help you process your experiences on top of your host family. One thing I did mention is that the exchange is one for one. So a host, say you wanted to go somewhere, your parents would host the other kid, the other family's kid. So it's a direct one for one. So not only do you and that other teenager get a cultural immersion, but also your parents will most likely talk to each other and work with each other how to be a parent for the other kid.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, that's so cool. Yeah. And the parents like get a lot out of that too, right? I'm sure that experience. Yeah.
Yeah. There's SIBs involved. Like there's many layers of the exchange. On top of that, at any one school, our intent is to have more than one exchange student there. So, but they'll all be from different regions. So if you have school C, you'll have one student from school A and one student from school B exchange to school C. And so they can be each other's support network. And two, we won't have two school A kids go to school C because then they'll just lean on each other and be each other's buddy. Like,
right.
Lean on school B kid. And there's another layer of exchange.
That's smart. Yeah, because you know the A and the B is going to be really close because they are going through the same exact thing pretty much. So that's cool. And then you have exposure to another culture of whoever B is that is probably different than A. So then you get, it's like all three, it's like a win-win-win. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Or annoying.
I joke always cracks me up. I'm like, yep. Where the wind jokes. Lastly is that after they return home, then they become a part of the ALEX alumni network, where annually cool. We have events in order to maintain those relationships, kind of like your fraternity.
Yeah.
And how you right, where okay, now I met people who were very instrumental to a very pivotal part of my life. Mm. And can you maintain those relationships? By the way, these are probably the most diverse relationships you'll ever have.
Yeah. Because, yeah.
Like I was part of fraternity, but I guess you can call West Point a fraternity, but we all are kind of cut sort of in the same mold.
Yeah.
So like this one's, would be the teenagers, like most diverse network, but it's at the same thing. You had a mutual experience, shared experience that really connects you.
It's very, I mean, when we go do pledging, it's only one semester, right? But because we road tripped a lot, we met all the others that are going through the same thing, and we all went through like hardships and struggles together, and kind of that helped made us so close. And you know, I still hang out with my brothers all the time, and that was like 2007, so that was 14 years ago, and we still hang out, right? So it's like you said, that having that shared experience, that shared bond. Can and like you said, the diversity, right? That's the key, because like you said, so many of us are in our bubbles. So if we're going to be comfortable, it's really hard for us to have relationships in all these other regions, right? Like how many connections do I honestly have in Louisiana, or do I have in Arkansas? Like not as many, right? So it's like that would be helpful for me, just having a different perspective that I might not have thought about.
Exactly. Another way to view this is that it's also a national security endeavor. National security. What I mean by that is that it's pretty well known that foreign agents, as well as some local ones, want to sow conflict through misinformation, disinformation campaigns. So a way to counter that is that to actually know someone that the disinformation, misinformation campaign is trying to demonize or is trying to paint a false picture of. You're like, oh, hey, like the right wants to just hoard guns and start a revolution. And if you hear that, I'm like, well, I know some guys in Montana, and I know some guys in Idaho. And you're like, no, they're not like that.
Yeah.
I talk to him like once every 6 months. We're still friends now. Yeah. Or like when they hear like, oh yeah, the left wants to be all communists and take over everything in your life. I'm like, they'll ask me like, well, Tony's not like that. So, And so like that just keeps our Discord a little more civil and reality.
I love that. Yeah, you're completely right. Like I have a lot of friends that, I mean, I think the most eye-opening experiences was when I talked to someone who has a completely different background, right? Like there's a guy I know that is from Alabama, right? But he has like the biggest heart, right? He's so different than what you would typically think of like someone from Alabama, right? And then yeah, it's all these experiences that really help shape us to be more open-minded and actually try to and want to listen to another perspective that's different than ours. That's powerful. I love how you said it's a national, yeah, it reaches it's so big. Do you have a vision of like eventually how many people you would want to go through? Like, or it's just thousands of students one day? Like, have you thought about that yet?
That's my vision. So there's a program called the Erasmus program in the EU. They sort of do something similar to this, where they take college students and they swap colleges for a semester, and they partly fund it. It's estimated that about 5% of middle-aged college graduates went through the Erasmus program. The EU has dedicated $1 billion a year to this program, and so they see the value in mixing up points of views and a culture exchange, and so like that's a government program. That is an option. That'd be great if the U.S. government could see this as a worthy endeavor to continue to fund, because the State Department actually funds international exchanges.
So not at the national, we don't have anything at the national level yet.
Right. That as a government, as a people, the State Department sees value in international. Like, well, this is a different take on it, but just equally valuable.
Yeah, that's interesting that yeah, and I'm sure every certain states are more open to it, right, compared to other states who are That's fascinating. Yeah, I think anytime the government, like I think that's a cool thing about Europe, right? I do feel like I work for a company that's based in Berlin. We're going to Berlin on Saturday, and they do seem to be much more open to all these different like in Berlin, like my company, I think there's like 40 different, like it's only a company of 300, and there's like 40 different countries that folks have come in, and like, and so I love it because every day I'm learning something new about all these other countries that I would normally have no exposure to, right? So yeah, it's eye-opening for me. Like even I've only been here since April, and since then I've learned so much more about European countries prior than my 33 years before that. It's crazy to think. And even this past weekend, I went to New Hampshire, and it was my first time in New Hampshire, and that was such a like for me, it was really cool just to learn about the cultures there and seeing paintings about the scenery and nature and the mountains and stuff like that. So you can tell that that's like a really big part of their culture, right? A lot more nature activities compared to, when I was living in Manhattan, obviously. So.
Yeah, did you do you see a great difference between exposing yourself, getting exposure to different cultures digitally versus in person geographically?
That's a good question. Yeah, I mean, I think in person is definitely more eye-opening for sure. Like even when I went to London, which is not too different, but it was at the same time, it was a lot different, right? Yeah, I think immersing, like truly immersing yourself, like when I was in New Hampshire for 4 days, like that really opened up my eyes. I was like, whoa, like there's a whole different pace of living that doesn't have to be like rushing everything, that it was a much more calm feeling. And I feel like, yeah, I would never be able to get that online, right? Like I had to be there. Yeah, it's a weird world we live in now where everything's so digital, so we get like a very filtered lens on how we look at things,
Right. Yeah, and that's interesting. You mentioned that, like, because everything's so readily accessible, we think we know everything, or we think we can learn about something digitally. Like, oh, I don't know about that. I can quickly learn about that. Mm. I can wiki, whatever. And yet it hasn't been a substitute for actual in-person experiences. It probably gives us a false sense of knowledge. Mm. It gives us a false sense of knowledge. You're like, oh yeah, I know that. Do you? You know,
actually, it's kind of like Jersey. When I went to Vegas, I remember, and then everyone who saw my license, you know, when they checked your license for the casino games, mm-hmm. everyone was like, oh yeah, Jersey Shore, yeah. Like, what's it like at the, you know? So then it was funny because it was like, I heard Jersey Shore like 10 times and I'm like, Jersey is not really, like, that's like 1% of Jersey, right? It's
right.
But everyone, that was the perspective that everyone, like, they're like, oh yeah, like you go to the beach a lot and stuff like that. Yeah, I was like, no, I haven't been to the beach in like 3 years.
Yeah, you didn't drop a Jager bomb even once, probably.
I do like Jager bombs, though. That part is true.
they are delicious and devastating. They're all the things. Ugh, I got shivers.
I'm curious, like, when I saw that, you know, you're at West Point, I'm so curious, like, what was your experience like? Like, were you exposed to a lot of other cultures and a lot of, like, people that were from all over the U.S.? Like, what was that like?
Yeah, absolutely. So structurally, how the application part works for West Point or any military academy is that, like, every representative or senator or the VP or the president has the ability to nominate a high schooler to go to a military academy. And so whether or not they get in, that's due to the other half of the application, which is more or less a regular college application. And so there's some diversity, state diversity baked into the system. And so you're going to get a sampling of teenagers, cadets from every state, ideally. I mean, you can have, there's some parts where it can fail there. Like any one class could maybe not have enough qualified applicants from the Tennessee, for example. But in general, you're going to have some diversity baked in. And yeah, it's you're definitely, when you're there, I think it, with any military service, whether it's West Point or just you're enlisted, which I also did, you enter a system, you have a mutual experience, you're taught like, hey, here's some shared values you should have, and here's some activities that you should do together. In order to bond and better yourself. And through those, you realize, like, hey, I'm not that different from this person. Well, I am different, but we're still fundamentally the same because we're both here doing something together and constructive. So you definitely build bonds and you figure out how to work with each other. I thought about this maybe just a week ago where a lot of folks call for national service. And I think the last time we really had one was like either Vietnam or going farther back, World War II, where you had everyone, not everyone, but a large portion of America, mostly the boys then, pull together, do national service, and then you have diversity baked into that, exposure to different cultures. And so, like, we don't have the draft anymore and we don't have a world war in order to do that. So, like, all right, how do you get that? How do you get that exposure? And so I see ALEX as like, oh, here's another way to expose kids to different places and different cultures. My West Point experience has definitely fueled my drive to start ALEX, really. The other thing that I noticed is that in the military or even any time you have a system that exposes kids to different types of kids, you need a process in order to help them communicate with each other. Right, in corporate world they call it storming, norming, conforming. There's probably another one in there where you got a lot of diversity. All right, you got a storm. There's going to be conflict. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that's going to be good and sometimes that won't. And so like we push for workshop leadership and communication workshops because, hey, that doesn't have to be full of conflict and that doesn't have to be have negative outcomes. Given the right communication tools, that could be a great process. But you got to kind of do it before and during the whole exchange in order to have some constructive and have a constructive experience. So the Army doesn't really do that. They're getting better about it now. But that's something that I think is sort of a recent thing, the last 10, 15 years. You know, corporations do a lot of training, and so we take that some of that same approach towards the teens.
I think you're right. I don't think we have as many communication courses. I mean, I think it should be required in high school, right? It's like these are fundamental things that really help out someone out in life. And that's cool. So it sounded like you were exposed to so many folks from like all these different states and different regions and stuff like that. What was like one of some of the biggest like knowledge, something that you learned that really changed your perspective on things that, you know, prior to going into the military that you didn't know?
That's reaching back. I'm that was like two decades of reach, two plus decades. I grew up in California and, child of Vietnamese refugees. And we are one of our underlying values is family, adherence to family. Family is better, family is above individual, community is sometimes above individual. And going to West Point and meeting other folks, realize like, you know what, maybe that's not the underlining. Let me back up, even a better story. My deployment to Iraq, we had some cultural classes before. And one of the most interesting facts I remember is that like in Iraqi culture, the value of youth is less. In American culture, in Western culture, we value youth. The youth says, a young person has the promise of infinite promise. They have innocence, and we should value them over the elderly. That's kind of like a thing that we don't really speak about. And in Iraqi culture, it's the opposite. The old person has more value because they have accumulated experiences and wisdom. So if given a choice, you're like, well, we lean toward the old person and we give more value to their life. And the young person can be replaced more easily because they haven't lived enough life to matter as much. That's like kind of a dark way to approach it, but that's like kind of an underlining assumption.
Huh. Yeah, that's so true. You're right. U.S. does value. Yeah, that's fascinating. Yeah, like, there are some crazy, I mean, this is like you said, it is a weird social experiment, but most of the time in the US, they'll choose the baby over like an elderly person, right? That, you know, like an extreme example would be like someone who's 80 versus someone who's a newborn. Most people would choose the newborn over the 80-year-old, right?
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure where the value of youth comes from versus the value of age, but like that was the wow moment. Like, wow, that's a really fundamental thing to just address and shine a spotlight on, because these are assumptions that we don't really investigate.
Yeah.
Until we put ourselves next to something that looks pretty different.
Yeah. Wow. That's interesting. And I'm sure there were a lot of experiences, like when you were overseas, you've experienced a lot of your worldview shifted in a lot of different ways, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, absolutely. There's when I was in Iraq in 07, 08, there was basically a civil war. And the value of life is different there. And not because I don't think they intentionally care less about life. It's just, it's a lot more fragile. And my hypothesis is that you value life a little less because it's fragile and you don't want to be too attached to it.
Interesting.
That's totally my hypothesis. I didn't read that anywhere, but that's And so it makes me want to demonize that approach a little less. Like, oh, you're monsters because you care about life less than I do. I mean, you have a lot more dying in your life.
That's so interesting. I think you're right. Like, even in the US, like, we value life almost too much in a way where everyone thinks about death like all the time. Like, it's the one thing that, I mean, besides public speaking, everyone's the most afraid of, right? And it's like, if we kind of just accepted that, like, hey, we're all going to die eventually, maybe we wouldn't stop thinking about death and being afraid of death so much and just live our lives in a way, you know?
Yeah. And like, even though the perception of the value of life is a little different depending where you are in America. Some places lean more into like, oh, everyone we value life, that everyone should have a fair chance at it, or we try our best to save lives regardless. And some places they lean more into like a survival of the fittest, Darwinism, to include humans. And there's no right or wrong per se. It's just like that's our underlying assumptions that come out when you get to know folks.
That's interesting. Like, what's an area of the U.S. that you think that's more Darwinism?
I think a lot of the Midwest, a little bit of the Deep South, places that. I think this is just me talking now. Place that equates capitalism to Darwinism. I think they're very linked concepts. But that's painting a very broad picture. Like, you have pockets of
right, like
those. I'm glad you brought that up because. One of the five criteria we use to match families up is your cultural region. And we're inspired, Alex was inspired by the book called American Nations by Colin Woodward, where he identified 11 sub-American nations of North America. And explains like, where did your collective values come from? Appalachians, folks in Appalachians, for example, a lot of those folks came from Scotland Highlands, and so they took a lot of their culture with them, versus New England, which like has a Puritan upbringing, and so that hasn't changed. So like your cultural regions is one factor we use to mix up the kids, the teens. The other one is your socioeconomic background, your religion, your ethnicity, and your community type, urban, rural, suburban, farm. Need to change some of those criteria when you exchange, not all of them. All of them is like a big cultural shock.
Yeah, that might be too much for
that's a lot.
Yeah.
Working with other exchange folks from other programs, we're going to go with their learning is that you probably want to change about two, max three of those factors, but not all five.
I can see that, because it'd be so much of a shock that they might want to come back earlier. Like, they might not want to stick out the whole semester.
Precisely. And you're like, that's not the intent at all. Exposure, but not total cultural shock where you can't even function because you're just totally in a foreign land.
Yeah.
That's too much.
I think there's a certain breed of folks. I definitely noticed, like, anyone that has done any exchange program there. I mean, I wonder if it's like nurture versus nature, but I do know some folks that, like, every year they move to somewhere else. Right. And they're like, they're totally cool with it. Like, this is, they're just, you know, that they're just very adaptive. And then I know folks like, you know, my wife, for instance, like, she would never want to, like, move that many times. Like, that would be exhausting for her, right? So yeah. I think some people, like, really love it and they invite that. And then some folks, you know, maybe every, like, 4 or 5 years, right? But not every year.
Yeah, yeah. ALEX is one of our principles is curiosity. Where we look for host families and students, we're part of the same family, that have that quality, curiosity, because curiosity is what will enable you to process and thrive and really observe and learn about your new surroundings. And so the number one thing we look for, beyond grades, beyond recommendations, it is that quality that we look for. Whether or not we can foster it, that's a tough one. But in our application process and in the interview process, that's what we look for. Are you curious? If you're curious, then you can open up your own doors.
Yeah, I think even curiosity is a skill that some of us lose when we graduate from college, or when we get into the professional workforce, right? I feel like as children, we're so used to exploring, and then after enough, like, hand slaps, and after, like, enough sit down, like, stop moving around so much, like, you kind of feel like, yeah, it's interesting, right? It's like, I get it. Our parents are trying to get us to survive and not die, right? But after a while, you kind of, we get complacent I think sometimes we lose a sense of curiosity the older we get.
That's really interesting. Yeah. Like, curiosity, I think babies, children have a baseline level of curiosity that is much higher than what you end up with as an adult. And yeah, you're right. Your parents, society, your community, could punish or warn against certain types of curiosity, and that has an effect on your level and your type of curiosity, and because you're taught to fear certain things. Right? You can be curious about that, or you shouldn't be curious about that, because hey, that could hurt you. Like, stick your hand on, right? I'm curious about stoves. Well, no, that's going to burn you, so you shouldn't do it. That's legit. That mentality could expand into other types of curiosity could be detrimental. So, like, I don't know if you can re-foster curiosity after in an adult or in a teen. Not sure. But that's really interesting.
Yeah, that's a tough one. It's like, I think part of me thinks it's like innate, like you're born and maybe you're just curious. And then I also think, like, depends on who you surround yourself with as well, right? If you surround yourself with a lot of people who are just generally curious people all the time, who are always traveling or always exploring different regions or trying different new activities, then I think it's natural for you to be like, oh, wonder why they keep going to, you know, travel to this state or whatever. But I do think humans in general, like, naturally are more naturally curious, right? And then, like I said, society sometimes jades us, and then we get to a point where it's like, oh, well, we want to fit in, right? We don't want to stick out, like, we don't want to stand out too much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Acculturation is a survival mechanism. You're like, okay, I stick out too much. Does that mean that, like, I'm in danger? Maybe. We will want to acculturate a little bit. That reminds me of a great question. I got to listen to Colin Woodward, the author of American Nations, get interviewed about a week and a half ago, and someone posed a great question. They're like, okay, these 11 nations, they haven't really changed since they were developed, even though we've had a lot of internal movement of people, right? You bring your values to the new place you move to, and you're like, wait, how come they didn't kind of just get evened out and homogenized a bit? And his theory was that when you move to a new place, you acculturate to it, to its systems, rather than you change it to reflect yours. And so that's why these regions are still, geography matters. Likely to change rather than you change the place you move to.
Yeah, that's interesting. I definitely noticed that. Like, as someone who at one point I was like, I would never work in New York City. And then when I moved to New York City, I found myself really like changing to become like a more typical New Yorker. But then I noticed like it was exhausting, right? Like I noticed because I had to like really change who I am. So then as soon as I kind of like move away from New York, like I'm back to just being myself, right? But I think humans are always adapting. We're always changing, and it's a curse and a blessing, right? At the same time, because rejection is like one of the worst things as a human being. Like we're all innately hate rejection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really interesting. You mentioned like you moved to New York. You changed your behavior. You changed some of your perspectives in life, but you didn't. It sounds like you didn't really feel completely at home in New York.
And I mean, I eventually did, right? And then I don't know. It's interesting. I would say, yeah, my identity has changed, but then now that I'm back in Jersey, I'm like, oh, okay, like this is a little bit more like who I am, you know?
Yeah. That is that I think you are representative of a general trend in America, and I think in the world really, where you will move to places that allow us to see ourselves the way we want to see ourselves, feel at home. And so when you abstract that to like, oh, a bunch of people, a bunch of Davidsons doing that, what happens? Then you get little pockets of people who want to be close to people who are like them. And so that's that, like, what does that mean? Okay, that means that like you'll eventually build a lot of pockets, and then you'll start creating another you create a geographic bubble where you're like, hey, I get along with my neighbor because we sort of have fundamental values. And so like, yeah, swinging it back to Alex, you got to physically move out of there in order to get some exposure. That's a natural thing to just be surround yourself with people who think like you. It's just less emotional labor.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely noticed that at one point I was like, whoa, I made my life so I only hang out with Asians. And it was like, and then I didn't know that until one of my coworkers, the guy I saw this weekend, he always makes fun of me. He's like, you know, he's like, hey, like, I'm surprised you're hanging out with me because I'm not Asian, you know? And I'm like, no, it's not like that. And he's like, you know, so yeah, I think it, like you said, it can be less emotionally like draining, but it's also like, it's like comfort zone, right? And then I'm not growing because of that, because if I'm only surrounding myself with Asians, then like, I only know this worldview. I only know this perspective. It's hard for me to really get into the world of other people's perspectives, right? So now I'm like active, at least now that I'm aware, I'm actively making an effort to expand, right? But it is interesting how like before you know it, you're like, man, like I'm kind of in a bubble now, you know?
Yeah. And that's beautiful here. Because like you have a bubble, but then you're aware that you're in a bubble, and then you have access to folks a little bit outside your bubble, and then you endeavor to expand on that. Some folks have fewer access to folks outside their bubble,
right?
Because you're and I lost train of thought, but yeah, that's pretty cool. And you, yeah,
and then the tech bubble too, right? I'm like in this tech bubble now, and I'm like, man, like we keep forgetting that the whole world is about tech, but because we're in tech, like it's really hard for us to see the other perspectives, right? Non-tech people. Like I remember like during the pandemic, because we were tech, we were just on computers. So like we felt very safe, right? But there was a whole, there's millions of people literally dying from COVID, but I would never know because I'm like, well, I get to wake up, go downstairs to my office, work out of a computer. Like it seemed very safe to me. And then you hear on the news that there's like all these millions of people getting affected. I'm like, I never see any of this stuff, you know?
Yeah. No one I know, no one I'm close to got infected. Or if you're an essential worker, a lot of people you know got infected.
Yeah, yeah.
That's another way to categorize types of Americans, essential, non-essential, by the mechanism of how you work, how you need to work. COVID's one, it's exposed a lot of underlying truths about American society, and also heck, it's going to be a challenge for an exchange. Our first cohort is going to be in the spring of 2022. We may have to shift that to fall 2022 because of COVID, thanks Delta, and we'll see. It may have to be a little more modest, the size of the cohort. But heck, it needs to happen one way or another.
Yeah. Yeah. I think if anything, the pandemic, or because of the last year and a half, it's made us even tap more into our curiosity, because now I'm starting to see people who normally would never travel that really have that itch to go overseas and stuff like that. Right. So I think it's even, it's like even more, you know, I don't know. That's what I'm seeing on my end, like people that are really itching to travel.
That reminds me of what I think humans have a fundamental a thing about them, where our firsthand knowledge of anything, we value that more than any statistic. And so like knowledge of firsthand knowledge of anyone experiencing all the need to travel, for example, you're like, yeah. So I when we think that, you're like, oh yeah, that's part of a bigger trend, right? And I'm like, it's a sampling error.
That's a good point. Yeah,
it's a sampling error. And so like, well, how do you defeat sampling errors? Well, systematically, either you look at overarching trends that someone else study, or you just have more, you're able to get more samples.
I think we're inherently biased. It's almost impossible for us to be 100% unbiased, right? It's like humans to be biased in a way.
Yeah, it's more real to us if our friend, our close friend got COVID versus like someone I don't know, statistic,
right,
got COVID. That's just, it's not necessarily good or bad. It's just, I think that's the way it is. There's some interesting studies about othering, where we have a sense of who we are. Let me back up. So the study looked at how you can treat another person in a different jersey. It was soccer players, soccer teams, where they would walk up to a group of Team A fans wearing a Team A jersey, and they would get treated one way, and they go up, basically almost the same crew with a different jersey, and they're treated totally different, even though everything else is the same. Same person, just different.
It's crazy.
And you're like, hey, how did that happen? Oh yeah, you just assume whether or not you're part of the clan or not, and everything else being the same. I forgot the other findings of it, but like othering is a thing. We look for similar connections in relationships and like what's fundamental about Alex is that like it's intent, one of his intents is to point out that like, hey, we're all fundamentally American. Things different, but we're still fundamentally American, and that's more important than our differences.
Yeah, well that's a beautiful thing, and I appreciate you doing this and your vision, and looking forward to, and how can folks reach you? I'll link to your website and your LinkedIn. Are we looking to be connected with anyone in particular?
The site is alix.org, A-Y-L-X. Also the Instagram, the_alix. Our intent is to reach qualified students who are curious through youth programs, JROTC or church groups or after school programs, anyone who has an adult who can look a teenager in the eye and said, hey, I see something special in you. You have a curiosity. I think this program would be good for you. That's our mechanism to reach the teenagers. So if anyone knows of a youth group, or any group really, just to abstract it, but any group that has firsthand who works firsthand with teenagers, please reach out, and we'd love to talk and see if you think it's a curious and qualified student who should apply along with their family, of course.
Okay, cool. Well, thanks, Tony. I appreciate everything. And I'm sure we'll chat again soon.
Yeah, I appreciate you, Davidson. Thank you.